Genesis chapter 31. Now let's remind ourselves of a couple of things. Back in a few chapters earlier, we saw Jacob leaving his parents and his brother Esau and the land of Canaan and descending into the land of Padam Aram, the Aramean land, the land of the of Ur and Babylon, that area where Abraham came from, where Sarah came from, and where his mother Rebekah came from. And he's descending. And you know that he had cheated his brother, he deceived his father, and his brother Esau had sworn that the moment Father Isaac is dead, I'm going to come and I'm going to kill you, Jacob. And so Jacob flees. Two purposes in his flight. One is to stay alive, not be murdered by his brother. And the other is to get a wife. And he was very successful in both. In fact, he came back alive and with four wives. And so I'd say he did it very well. But this picture here, remember, the Bible's never talking about what the Bible's talking about. It's always imaging something deeper, something from the unseen realm, a common experience that we have. And this is it. All of us, because of the things in our lives, we descend into the world. And I'm not talking about just a physical birth. I'm talking we learn to somehow come in and depend on the world system against our better judgment. And as we come to, back to the Lord, as we turn to Him, as we develop a childlike faith again, we disengage from that. We have to. We don't go out of the world, but we take our hearts out of it. And we begin to realize it's not this present world that I can see that I get my security from. It's not what I depend on for my welfare, for my success, and for blessing in my life. This is just the chessboard. But I have to realize that I get my security from an unseen realm. I'm a citizen of a world to come. My king is not an earthly king. He's an eternal king. And I begin to invest my life in things that are truly eternal and alive. And what we see in these two chapters is Jacob making the move back. He's immersed and God has blessed him. And now he's going to remove from this. Now, up to this time, he's been almost a slave to Laban, his father-in-law. And Laban has been blessed and blessed and blessed. But then we saw last week where Laban, his conniving heart, begins to try to cheat Jacob in cheating. And what's amazing is when Laban treats Jacob well, Jacob is blessed. And when Laban treats Jacob terribly, Jacob's still blessed. Because his blessing comes from the father, not from Laban. But Laban's story isn't like that. When Laban blesses Jacob, Laban is blessed. But when Laban is not blessing Jacob and begins to cheat him and change his wages and tries to squeeze him, we see Laban cursed. You see, the promise that God had made to Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you and I'll curse those who curse you, we see Laban now entering into the curse of that. And here's where things stand. It says in verse 1, then he heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken all that belonged to our father, and from that which belonged to our father he amassed all this wealth. Now, that word for wealth there in the Bible, or riches, or whatever word you have, is actually the word kavod, the word for glory in Hebrew. And as I was reading this, I jotted down that whatever glory we may earn in this world, it is earned via the sufferings that are inflicted upon us. Think about that. Laban had caused great suffering to Jacob. Jacob had suffered in many ways, just by the tremendously hard work he did. The 7 years he worked for Rachel, only to get Leah, then had to work another 7 years for Rachel. Then he worked on another 6 years. And he suffered terribly during this time. But the glory didn't come from Laban. The glory came from God. And it came through suffering. And in this world, we'll experience suffering. But it's only through that suffering that we truly learn discipline, we learn faith, We grow in maturity. And you know, suffering's painful, but it's not bad. There's a huge difference. There's a huge difference. And it says, Jacob also noticed Laban's disposition, Laban's face, that behold, it was not toward him as in earlier days. And Adonai said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your native land, and I will be with you. Jacob had tried to return 6 years earlier, but he stayed on a little longer to build up his flocks, but now it is time to go. Jacob sent and summoned Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, I have noticed that your father's face is not toward me as in earlier days, but the God of my father was with me. Now you have known that it was with all my might that I served your father, yet your father mocked me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not permit him to harm me. Now, please get hold of this. You know, I don't care how the world treats you, how that godless employer treats you, how the neighbors or whatever it is you're going through, however it treats you, and whatever suffering you go through, if you're living a life devoted to the Father, you're going to be blessed and blessed and blessed. You're going to increase. It doesn't mean you get rich. In this case, Jacob got rich, but it's a picture of something else. It's a picture of the eternal wealth that we are laying up for ourselves in heaven. We're going to prosper from this. I'm not a faith prosperity guy by any stretch of the imagination. You may die in this world a pauper, only to awake in the next one, Bill Gates, and wake up so rich. And I'd rather be poor for a short time here and wealthy for eternity than wealthy for a short time here and eternally poverty stricken. Because some people go through judgment and suffer loss. They'll come into the kingdom, but they're going to suffer loss. Paul tells us that very clearly in 1 Corinthians 3. And you know, when you look at Laban, you see a picture of anti-Semitism as well. Because as you study Laban's life, you're going to see everything that's indicative of anti-Semitism in this world. Consider these points. Laban wanted Jacob nearby for what he can do. He wanted Jacob nearby because whatever Jacob did, Jacob was blessed. The flocks multiplied. Everything just flourished. And this is the same way with the Jewish people. When you make a home in your country for the Jewish people, that country is blessed. The Jewish people bring blessing wherever they go. But he wants Jacob to bring prosperity, but not to have prosperity. He was tickled to death with all the prosperity Jacob brought to him, but he was jealous of the prosperity Jacob himself had. He's angry if Jacob leaves. He's angry if he stays. Jacob had made Laban wealthy. But Laban perceived Jacob's wealth as stolen. And you're going to see Laban saying that very thing to him later. Laban experienced both the blessing and the cursing part of God's promise to Abraham. And that is true of the nations today. They're going to be blessed if they bless Israel. They're going to be cursed if they curse Israel. Remember what the word curse means there back in a place where it is made earlier in Genesis. We don't think of cursings as like something from Harry Potter where you say some spell and all of a sudden the person breaks out in warts or whatever and turns into a rat. That's not what we're talking about. Cursing is the opposite of blessing. Blessing in your life simply means the way is smoother. It means the efforts you invest bring greater fruit than they normally would. It means that their doors open a little easier than they normally would. It means that a lot of problems that would normally come your way, you're spared from. They just don't come your way. All right? There's still suffering. There's still some difficulties, but they're light. The yoke is easy. The burden's light. Cursing's the opposite. The road is rougher than it needs to be. Doors don't open as easily as they should, or you'd like them to, or they don't open at all. Everything's a little heavier. Everything pulls down on you a bit more. You can still make progress. You can still make a living. But the way of the transgressor is difficult, the word says. This is what curse is. All right? So here's normal. Blessing pushes you one way. Curse just simply makes it harder, pushes you the other way. And Laban's way had become very difficult. But Jacob goes on to explain what he's talking about. He says, but God did not permit him to harm me. Verse 8, if he would stipulate spotted ones shall be your wages, then the entire flock bore spotted ones. If he would stipulate ringed ones shall be your wages, then the entire flock bore ringed ones. Thus God took away your father's livestock and gave them to me. It once happened at the mating time of the flock that I raised my eyes and saw in a dream, behold, the he-goats that mounted the flock were ringed, speckled, and checkered. And an angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, raise your eyes, if you please, and see that all the he-goats mounting the flocks are ringed, speckled, and checkered. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made me a vow. Now arise and leave this land and return to your native land. Remember last week reading about the striped poles that Jacob had put by the runnels when they would come through, and if he put striped poles up, then all the sheep bore striped lambs? Remember, the poles had nothing to do with anything. And this is the passage that lets us know God says, I was watching. But whatever Laban said would be your wages, then I made them come out that way. And the whole idea of putting these things for the sheep and the goats to look at, ridiculous. It did nothing, absolutely nothing. God was in control all the time. And I wonder if Jacob was shocked at that. I wonder if Jacob all along thought, I've really got something going here. I could sell this idea. But it turned out the idea was a failure, but God's blessing was still a success. And so Rachel and Leah replied and said to him in verse 14, Have we then still a share and inheritance in our father's house? Are we not considered by him as strangers? And look what they say. This is very insightful. It says, for he has sold us and even totally consumed our money. In other words, he didn't give us to you as brides. He sold us to you. And then he's consumed our money. See, normally a man will give a bride price for a bride. He will pay the father-in-law a good size amount of money for a bride. And then at the wedding, that father will then take a part of that and give it to his daughter as a gift. Well, basically, Laban sold off his daughters and didn't give them anything. You see? Laban was a greedy guy. By the way, I want us to take a look at a couple things about Laban that I think are interesting. You're going to notice in this chapter that instead of referring to Laban just as Laban, it more often than not refers to him as Laban, the Aramean. Now, we knew from earlier that he's an Aramean. But there's some interesting things going on here in the Hebrew. And whenever the language emphasizes something or takes a little bit of a turn, you need to home in on that and find out what it means. Now, most of you know already that the name Laban, Lavan in Hebrew, it means white, right? But when you reverse it, it becomes Nabal, fool. Laban may have looked like he was all pristine and clean and just a wonderful guy, but when you reverse the name, you saw the essence of what he was. He was a fool. Lavan ha'arami means the Aramean. Aram is the land. Those are the middle three letters here. We take those middle three letters, the word for Aramea or Aram. And Aram means to be kind of lifted up, exalted, raised up. And you reverse it, it becomes Mara, to be rebellious or fat. Laban looked like he was pure and clean, Lavan, white, and someone who's exalted and strong and in charge. But when you reverse the Hebrew, he was a rebellious, fat fool. Here's the lesson for the world. I know what it's like to be a young person. You go through puberty, then a year or so later, all of a sudden the world out there looks a lot more attractive than home. And you think, out there, I can be lifted up. People will, unlike my parents, people out there recognize me for the talented, good-looking person I am. And I'll get the praise and the attention out there that mom and dad just seem to want to take away from me all the time. And you think that out there, that's what Lavan Ha'arami is. But when you get out there, you find out that everything the world has to offer is foolish, rebellious, and fat. out of shape, out of order. It just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. Well, let's move on. Verse 19. Jacob, he settles up the family and all of his livestock, all of his property, and they leave. They don't tell Laban. And that's the best way to get out of the world. If you plan on turning your life over to the Lord, don't tell your worldly friends first before you do it. I'll talk you out of it every time. Just do it. Just follow the Lord. Just obey Him. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the teraphim. These are idols that belong to her father. Now, you know, the rabbinic sages, the rabbis, they always like to define the characters in the Bible, especially the patriarchs and matriarchs. And they try to say, well, Rachel stole those because she just didn't want to see her father practicing idolatry anymore. So she stole his idols. Look, you're going to stop people from performing idolatry. You destroy their idols, so you don't steal them. In fact, there's a legend in Judaism about Abram when he was a little boy. And Abram, even as a little boy, he had a heart for God, for the one true God. And Abram's father was he had a little boutique where he was a boutique or boutique? Boutique. He had a shop where he made idols and sold idols, okay? And this just drove Abram crazy. He just couldn't stand this. So one day, when his father's away from the shop and Abram was in charge, what Abram did, he took a hatchet and he broke up all the idols, the wood ones, the stone ones, the ceramic ones. He just broke them all up except for one big one. And then he put the hatchet in the hand of that idol. And when his father came home, it's like, Abram, what happened here? And Abram says, well, father, I made a meal for the idols. And when I put the food up for them, they all started fighting over it. And then this one came along with a hatchet and destroyed all the rest. And then his father said, you stupid boy, they're just wood and stone. And then Abram looked his father back in the face and said, why do you worship them? And then he ran. And whether the story is true or not, it has a lot of truth in it. So anyways, you don't steal idols to keep people from performing idolatry. You destroy idols. But she steals them. And verse 20. And it says also that Jacob stole the heart of Laban. Now in your translations, it may say he deceived Laban. But the same word, the root is ganav. He stole the heart of Laban. That's what it means to deceive somebody. And this is a term that's used several times in the narrative. You see, when someone believes you, that means they're giving you a part of their heart. Okay? If they're trusting you, they're taking a part of their heart and committing it to you. And if you're true, they know their heart's safe with you. But if you're not, they know that they can cause great pain. And so Rachel steals the teraphim, and Jacob steals Laban's heart. And later Laban says, why did you steal my heart? He says, by not telling him that he was fleeing. Thus he fled with all he had. He rose and crossed the river, and he set his direction toward Mount Gilead. Now, it's not named Mount Gilead yet. It's named Mount Gilead at the end of the chapter. Well, anyways, Laban finds out that he's left with his daughters, Jacob's four wives, and all the 11 grandsons, and however many granddaughters, and all the flocks. And it says in verse 25, Laban overtook Jacob. Jacob had pitched his tent on the mountain, while Laban had stationed his kinmen on Mount Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have stolen my heart and led my daughters away like captives of the sword? Why have you fled so stealthily and robbed me? Nor did you tell me, for I would have sent you off with gladness, with songs, with timbrel and with lyre. Right. And you did not even allow me to kiss my sons and daughters. Now you have acted foolishly. Now this is something very important here. Who told Jacob to flee? Who told him to get out of Dodge and get now? God did. And he did. But what does Laban say? You acted foolishly. Boy, this really exposes truth and falsehood, doesn't it? Jacob obeys the Lord directly, and Laban says, you acted like a fool. And who's the fool here? Laban. And then he goes on, it is in my power to do you all harm, but the God of your father addressed me last night, saying, beware of speaking with Jacob either good or bad. Now, you have left because you long greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Before we go on, I just want to share something with you. This whole stealing your heart. What was Laban really concerned about? Of flocks, of goats, and of sheep, and of camels, and all the other animals, all the wealth that Jacob was taking, that he had earned fairly and squarely all above board. He had not stolen one single thing. Though Laban had tried to cheat Jacob, the more he tried to cheat Jacob, the more Jacob was blessed. But then he asked Jacob, why did you steal my heart? I wonder if this is the passage that Yeshua was thinking of in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where thieves break through and steal and moth and rust corrupts, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven for where your heart is. I'm sorry, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Interesting thing to think about, isn't it? Laban's treasure was on earth, and that's where his heart was, and his heart was going out of town with Jacob. We need to lay up treasures in a place where they can't be taken away. Phil, your hand is up first.
He goes after and he has a treaty. He is warned from coming to treat Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he wants his idols. Yeah. So, you know, here you have a man who essentially has seen a man who serves, you know, God, who by serving him blesses his household.
Yes.
Yet he still tries to cheat him. He deceives him. He makes him work for him as a slave.
Yeah.
He then has God of the universe speak to him in a dream.
Right.
But he still pursues, and then he wants his idols back.
Well, what does Laban backwards spell? Fool.
It's just amazing.
Absolutely. Well, he says earlier that he has learned by Nachash, which means serpent, or we translate divination, that, you know, God is with Jacob. He's seen God bless Jacob. He's even said, I realize your father has blessed you. He's spoken to by an angel, just like you said, warning him, don't do anything to Jacob. Don't speak good or bad to him. Don't you curse him. And he's had all these brushes with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And yet, like you said, he wants his idols back. The man was foolish. The man was foolish. You know, people, and I know there's a little rabbi trail here. I get a little frustrated with all the books I see, and I see Christians publishing them, and I see Jewish publishers publishing them. And they're interesting. There is nothing wrong with them, but I think we have way too high expectations of these books. And these are books who try to scientifically prove to the non-believer that God exists, and therefore you should serve him. And I don't know, maybe there's some of you out here who were brought to faith through reading one of these. You'll be the first one I've ever met. Because you see, the person who chooses not to serve God has chosen not to serve him. And the person who chooses to serve God chooses to serve him, but it's never based on logic. It's based on something much deeper. Something much deeper. And as Ben read during the prayer service from 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, you know, God bypasses logic and so-called human wisdom, and he goes to something much deeper, something spiritual. It's an awareness in your heart of what's right, what's wrong, what's true, and what's not. And so you can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt somebody God exists, and they still won't believe in him, they still won't surrender to him. And other people who have no proof he exists, as far as scientific proof, serve him with all their heart, with all their lives. Because it's something deeper than logic. You know, there's a principle in Judaism that the person who chooses not to believe will see proof everywhere that God doesn't exist. And the person who chooses to believe sees proof everywhere that God does exist. Because you're looking at the world through one set of eyes or a different set of eyes. And the one eye, set of eyes sees one thing, and the other set of eyes sees something completely different. So I want this set of eyes that sees the invisible, that sees him. And that's what the next chapter is really about. We have a couple other hands up here. Jim, your hand was up next, and then we'll take Janet.
What is the significance of Rachel's stealing the eyeball and then even deceitfully hiding it?
Yeah, why did she take them? I think she was raised in a tradition she had never quite shaken loose. She still believed these idols had some power of some sort. That's the only thing I can figure. And we'll find out later, not it'll be next week, that a lot of the other family members of Jacob's family and servants had idols as well. Okay? And then he has them, he kind of shakes them loose. But she must have had some tradition in her mind, still clung emotionally to that. You know, I find that people who move from one religious background into another, especially if they're coming into one that's closer to the truth, many times there's an emotional attachment to the past. They know in their minds what they did was wrong. They know in their minds that the theology was wrong. But there's still this emotional attachment, a cord that's hard to cut. I've met it many times. And it seems like the more idolatry that's involved in that past, and the more trappings that were to that past religion, the more difficult it is to cut the emotions. And I think maybe that's the same thing is true here with Rachel. I'm just guessing, though. Yeah. Janet, your hand is up.
Yeah, I want to go back to verse 24.
Okay.
Did God change the way the Assyrian and the Greek by this? But it's like, he that thou speak not Jacob is neither good nor bad. Mm-hmm. And then he goes over and he tells them, the God of your father spake to me yesternight, saying, take thou heed that thou speak not to Jacob neither good nor bad. How in the world can he see God in a dream and do what he did? Because the Hebrew... shed any light on that?
No. He encountered God in a dream. But you know what? I think Laban probably thought, well, that's Jacob's God, my God of the teraphim. And you hear this a lot today in the New Age movement, and it's filtered down into common dialogue where people say, well, that's your truth. That's your truth. Is it truth? Truth is truth is truth. What do you mean my truth? I don't own the truth. The truth is truth. I want to know the truth. But, that drives me crazy. It just drives me nuts. Phil.
I was going to comment on part of the verse again, right, which is when Laban spoke to Jacob, this really reminds me of times current now, when he spoke to him about the vision, he said that it was the God of Jacob's father. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think that he has kind of pre-knowledge, let's say, even while he's worshiping idols, of who Jacob worships and what he does and the blessings going on in his life. And almost like we see nowadays, this time, oh, that's old.
Yeah.
He's got all these new things. He's got all these new idols and these other things. So,
yeah.
But that seems to be a common thing with people.
Good point.
And don't go with them, it's always the God of that person's father or something.
Right.
Past.
Right. Yeah, good point. Yeah, we tend to think that when things get old, they become untrue. As if you tell truth by using a calendar. I don't get that. What I'm going to do, for the sake of time, you can hopefully you've read the chapter, and but Jacob and Laban, they come to an agreement. They make a covenant. And of course, as Laban searches through the tents, he doesn't find the teraphim. You know how Rachel, she deceived her father. Rachel, in a way, has done the two things Jacob did back in Canaan. She stole and she deceived. Okay? And you could argue whether Jacob actually stole the birthright. He actually gave his brother some red bean soup. But in a way, it was theft. And he deceived his father for the birthright. And you see Rachel doing a similar thing for her father. But anyways, Laban cannot find the teraphim. And so when he doesn't find them, Jacob has this outburst. Verse 38. Actually, we'll start with verse 36. Then Jacob became angered, and he took up his grievance with Laban. Jacob spoke up and said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? When you rummaged through all my things, what did you find of all your household objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, and let them decide between the two of us. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I eat rams of your flock. That which was mangled I never brought you. I myself would bear the loss. From me you would exact it, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. This is how I was. By day, scorching heat consumed me, and frost by night. My sleep drifted from my eyes. This is my 20 years in your household. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wage 10 times. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the dread of Isaac been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. God saw my wretchedness and the toil of my hands, so he admonished you last night." Now, when he started looking for the teraphim, Jacob said, "Whoever hands you, whoever's possession you find it in, they shall not live." What's interesting, Rachel died very shortly thereafter. The sages say that if Jacob had said, "Whoever you find him with shall die," they said she would have died right then. But she lived a while longer, gave birth to Benjamin, then the childbirth, she died. Right on the way there to Jerusalem, and Isaac's home in the area of Hebron, I believe. But she died there at Bethlehem, and that's where Benjamin was born. We'll get to that though later on. But what does Laban say? Verse 43. Then Laban spoke up and said, "Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flock is my flock, and all that you see is mine, 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 mine. Yet to my daughters, what could I do to them? This? But I'm so generous, I'll let you have it." This is a fool talking. This is a fool talking. Well, anyways, Jacob sets up a stone there in verse 45. Jacob then took a stone and raised it up as a monument. Remember, Jacob stood up a stone when he left Canaan to cross over. And now he's getting ready to go back. He sets up a stone again. We're going to look here next as we get to chapter 32. I'm going to hurry to get there. Because chapter 32, this is all leading up to that, but 32 is the focal point of what I want us to look at this evening. It's just an absolutely amazing story here. And it's your story and my story. It's Yeshua's story. It's the story of Israel. It's the story of Adam and Eve to a great degree. And this is a truth that if we can just hold on to this truth, this is one of the most life-changing things I have ever experienced. It could be one of the most life-changing things you'll ever experience if you can just grasp what is in this chapter. Here we go. Let's pick it up. In chapter 32, verse 4. Then Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to Esau, his brother, to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. He charged them, saying, "Thus shall you say to my lord, to Esau, so said your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and have lingered until now. I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, servants and maidservants, and I am sending to tell my lord to find favor in your eyes, to find grace in your eyes." Esau and Jacob are twins. And if you remember back to the teaching we did, when Rebekah was pregnant with these two twins, they were fighting within her. And she goes to the Lord, "What's going on?" He says, "Two nations are warring in your womb, and from your womb two peoples will be separated. And the younger will rule over the older. The older will come under the dominion of the younger." The older was Esau. I remember when he was born, Jacob was born holding onto his heel. They were born together. They were born attached. And they are a picture, a clear picture of our neshama and our nefesh. They're a clear picture of the spirit and the body. And they're meant to be together. But God separates them. Because he needs to deal with Jacob, but now he's to put them back together again. You see, Jacob loved his brother Esau. He didn't want Esau dead. Esau wanted Jacob dead. And your spirit does not want your body dead. You want your body to be healthy and alive so you can accomplish your mission in this world. Your body, it wants your spirit dead because your spirit ruins all the fun. You see? As your spirit is interested in the world to come, your body is interested in this world. And so God had to deal with Jacob. And the wonderful things, one of the first things I want you to realize here, when God changed Jacob, the relationship with Esau changed as well. Even though Esau was far away, as God worked in Jacob's heart and changed Jacob and brought him to maturity and broke him, as we're about to see, Esau gladly comes under. You see? And the way you get your flesh to cooperate with your spirit is not by always trying to be good, change. If you walk in the spirit, you don't fulfill the lust of the flesh. The way you deal with the flesh is by focusing on the spiritual and keeping the body under that, building up the spiritual, feeding the spiritual, growing up spiritually. And what you find is there's peace that begins to come in. And your levav becomes a lev. If you don't want to talk about it, you have to go back to one of the tapes here a few weeks ago. Verse 7, then the angels returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother, to Esau. Moreover, he's heading toward you, and 400 men with him. So how many people are coming toward Jacob? 401. 401. What two letters in the Hebrew alphabet add up to 401? The first one and the last one. The Aleph, which equals 1, and the Tav, which equals 400. 401, Aleph and Tav. You see what it's talking about? The word is on its way to you. But to Jacob, it's the enemy on his way to him. But it's the Aleph and Alpha and Omega, the Aleph and the Tav. Let's move on. Verse 8. Jacob became very frightened and it distressed him. So he divided the people with him and the flocks, cattle, and camels into two camps. And he said, if Esau comes to the one camp and strikes it down, then the remaining camp shall survive. Then Jacob said, God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Adonai, who said to me, return to your land and to your relatives, and I will do good with you. I have been diminished by all the grace, all the kindnesses, and by all the truth that you've done for your servant. That's a powerful verse. I have been reduced. I have been made small. Katan is the root word used there. I've been made small. I've been diminished. I've been shrunken down by what? All the kindnesses and by all the truth you have done for your servant. That's wonderful news. And if you've been shrunken down and reduced and made small because of all the kindnesses God's done to you and all the truth He's poured in your life, you know what Jacob's talking about. Sometimes in the early days in our religious zeal, we want to eat up the Word so we can impress everybody with it. We want to just consume the Word of God so we can beat down everybody else in a theological argument. We want to grow in maturity so people will listen to what we have to say. And just the opposite happens. Instead of beating down other people, we get beat down. Instead of people listening to us, they give us the raspberries. You know, it all just goes upside down. But when we start to truly experience God's kindnesses and experience His truth, not necessarily our church's theology, but His truth, when we really begin to let that sink into our lives, it makes us small. It makes us small. And smallness, remember, humility and smallness is the secret to spiritual power. Smallness and anonymity are the secret to spiritual power. And Jacob has been diminished. He's been made small. He says, for with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he come and strike me down, mother and children. And you had said, I will surely do good with you, and I will make your offspring like the sand of the sea, which is too numerous to count. Remember, we talked about when Jacob crossed from Canaan over into Haran, the land of his mother and of his grandparents, what did he have with him when he crossed? He had a staff in his hand, but what else? He had words from God. That's all he had. That's all he had when he went in. What does he have now when he comes out? He has a staff in his hand and words from God. He sends the flocks and the family and the kids all across. He goes back in the same way he came out. With a rock standing up and a staff in his hand and words from God, that's all he has. And when we come full circle, we begin to realize those joyous days when we first became a believer, we didn't know much. But we had encountered the kindness and the truth of God. And we were filled with joy. And somewhere along the way, we can tend to lose that. But I think when we finally start to come to maturity, we go back to where it's just the staff in our hand and the words of God. And all the other stuff is just His lessons for us. But it is His words and our staff and nothing else. And that's what the joy really is. Do you still have the flocks and all those? Yeah, you know what? It's His words. That's what sustains me. And it's His staff. It's been my companion. And that's all. And that's where the real joy and the freedom is. Verse 14, he spent the night there, then he took from that which had come in his hand a tribute to Esau's brother, 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, and 20 rams, 30 nursing camels with their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 she-donkeys, and 10 he-donkeys. He put in his servant's charge, each drove separately, and said to his servant, now this isn't everything he has, this is just what he's given to Esau. Pass on ahead of me and leave a space between drove and drove. He instructed the first one, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, whose are you? Where are you going? And whose are these that are before you? You shall say, your servant Jacob's. It is a tribute sent to my Lord, to Esau, and behold, he himself is behind us. He similarly instructed the second, also the third, as well as all who followed the drove, saying, in this manner shall you speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, moreover, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him. The word there is Kippur. I will cover his face. So the word Yom Kippur, I will Kippur his face with a tribute that precedes my face. And afterwards I will face him. Perhaps he will lift up my face. That's what it says in the Hebrew. A lot of faces in this chapter. So the tribute passed on before him while he spent the night in the camp. But he got up that night, took his two wives, his two handmaids, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And when he took them and had them across over the stream, he sent over all his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man jumped him, wrestled with him, fought him, whatever word you want to use, until the break of dawn. When he perceived that he could not overcome him, the man could not overcome Jacob, that is, he touched the socket of his hip. So Jacob's hip socket was dislocated as he wrestled with him. Then he said to Jacob, that is, let me go, for dawn has broken. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? He replied, Yaakov, which means heel or grasper. He said, no longer will it be said that your name is Yaakov, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with man and have overcome. Then Jacob inquired, and he said, divulge, if you please, your name. And he said, why do you inquire of my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, the face of God. For I have seen God face to face, yet my soul was saved. The sun rose for him as he passed Penuel, face of God, and he was limping on his hip. Therefore the children of Israel do not eat the displaced sinew on the hip socket to this day, because he struck Jacob's hip socket on the displaced sinew. What is this all about? This is one of the most powerful and amazing and insightful passages in the entire Bible. It really is. Where else do you find God and a man wrestling in the dust? and the man winning the match. It's right here. And in every one of our lives too. Every single one of them. This is a struggle that began in the Garden of Eden. It's a struggle that occurs in every single life. It's a struggle that takes place between Israel as a nation and their God. It's a struggle that takes place between the entire world and God. This struggle here is a picture of everything in this world, every individual on the individual scale, and everything on a huge world scale. This is it. Right here, if we can grasp this, we're going to grasp something absolutely amazing. When Jacob was jumped there while he was all by himself, you're Jacob, all right? Who is it that jumped you? Esau. It has to be Esau. He's the guy who wants to kill you, for Pete's sake. He's the one who's coming toward you. How in the world did he get to me in the dark and jump on me all of a sudden? But it's Esau. This is your enemy. He wants to kill you. You don't want to kill him. He's your brother. But he wants to kill you. He has sworn that he'll kill you. So for all practical purposes, Jacob spends the night not wrestling God, but wrestling his enemy. Who's your enemy? Satan? Flesh? Yourself? It's all the above. And in the dark, we wrestle and we wrestle and we wrestle. But the moment the light starts to come up, we realize this is God Himself. God was in the battle all along. The flesh, the world, the devil, all these other things, they were just His instruments. It was Him Himself I was really wrestling with. It was God Himself. Nothing else. I mean, Isaiah 45, over and over, God says, I am the Lord, and beside me there is nothing else. Nothing else. That's what it says in the Hebrew. Nothing else. It doesn't say no one else. It says nothing else. Nothing else. Let's walk through some things here. They'll help to give us a framework for what is going on. I call this overhead there and back again. The left column is Jacob leaving Canaan and going down to Haran. And the right column is the story of how he leaves Haran to come back to Canaan. It's a wonderful story. It's a menorah pattern, and you might want to jot this down so you can think about these things later. Jacob leaves Canaan because he's fleeing from red. Jacob leaves Haran because he's fleeing from white. Remember Esau's name, Edom, means red. If you remember back, that's what his name means. Laban's name means white. And there's a whole world of stuff we could get into with red and white here, but we're not going to. When Jacob is leaving Canaan, the sun is going down, and he has his dream. Okay? But when he's leaving Haran, and he steps across to meet his family, meet his brother, the sun is coming up. Jacob had cheated and deceived in Canaan. He had been cheated and deceived in Haran. And in Canaan he had been blessed, and in Haran he had been blessed. This is the amazing thing about our God. You have to understand this. Is he saying, go ahead and cheat and deceive, I'll bless you anyway? That's not what he's saying. But you know what? When you look back at the things you've done wrong, and you've paid the consequences for those things, even those things somehow become a blessing. Those things you were ashamed of years ago, before you became a son of a child of God, now those things are a testimony that minister to others. Those years you may have spent in drug addiction now become a ministry to drug addicts. You follow? Your experience in whatever sin it was back there now becomes your ministry to those who are caught in that. They become tools for freedom. Where sin abounds, grace superabounds. Don't ever forget that. And then, of course, Paul in Romans, in the next verse, he has to say, therefore shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? He says, God forbid. Don't ever use this for an excuse for sinning. I remember as a kid, we'd always have these people trot them through our church, these terrible sinners, you know, and they always show how they were just in the dregs of sin. Any sin in the catalog, I mean, they had done it and God had saved them out of it. And I kept thinking, boy, I need to go out in the world and make a testimony for myself. Because what? I haven't done any of that stuff. Nobody's going to listen to me. You know? I was raised in a Baptist church. I'm still a Baptist. I mean, well, okay. What difference does that make? I needed a good, healthy dose of sin in my life so I could have a test. That's how I thought. But you know what? You wind up getting enough sin in your life without trying. And so don't go out there trying to make a renowned testimony for yourself by being the world's biggest sinner. Paul already has you beat at that. He was the chief of sinners. It was night when Jacob finally, you know, after the dream of the ladder, and he sets forth, it's night here. But that was night right after sundown. This is night before the dawn. Now, this is very important. Two big events happen. When he leaves, there's the dream of the ladder, the sulam, that reached from heaven to earth. And here, as he goes back in the night, there's the wrestling match with God himself. In the first one, Jacob is asleep. The body is still. The flesh is just dead asleep, unconscious. But his mind, his soul, is very much alive because God's speaking to him. And he's seen angels ascending and descending on this ladder. And God speaks to him. So the body is still, but he sees God clearly. It says God stood over him, and the Hebrew even allows you to translate, he stood by him. Very close encounter with God, but he knew who he was encountering. Over here, he's awake, and the flesh is very active. He is in a wrestling match for his life. And he has no idea that this is God. You see the differences? Exact opposites of each other. In the one, he dreams, and the other, he wrestles. In the one, he dreams of a ladder reaching heaven, and the other, he wrestles a man in the dust. The dream brought promises, and when you see the men of God having dreams, the men of God, they're filled with promises. Abraham, God puts him into a deep sleep when God passed between the sacrifices as a burning torch and as a smoking oven. Abraham's asleep, and God speaks wonderful promises to him. Jacob was asleep there when he dreamed of the ladder, and God speaks these wonderful promises to him. Joseph, as a young boy, we'll see later, when he's a young boy, he shares his dreams with his brothers. Wonderful promises. His brothers didn't think so, but they were wonderful promises to Joseph. Now, Gentiles and people who are not necessarily men of God, when they have dreams, it's usually warnings. It's usually bad things. Like Abimelech. You know, God tells him, if you don't let... This is Abraham's wife, Sarah, you've got here. I'm going to kill you if you don't let her go. Pharaoh has dreams about 7 years of famine are coming. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about these kingdoms that are all going to be destroyed when the kingdom of God comes. Okay, so when we see men of God have dreams are filled with promises, other men filled with warnings. So he receives all these promises, but over here, when the flesh is active, when the flesh is engaged, he receives transformation because God is breaking the flesh. You know, Jacob may have won the match, but God won the man. And he walked with a limp the rest of his life because of that. The promises of God come first. When we first become a believer, we are so grateful for all His promises. We try to make use of every one of them. We want to rip them out of God's hand, put them in our pocket, and start spending them as fast as we can. But then later, God wrestles with us in a very physical way and breaks us up. He brings pain to our bodies. He brings suffering to our finances. He will bring things to our life that we think we're going to die. And that's only because we're so closely attached to this stuff. And the more closely attached we are, the more painful it is. But that's where transformation comes. When Jacob left after the dream of that ladder, he was filled with hope and joy, but he was still the same Jacob. The transformation would come later when God broke him. When Jacob awoke from the dream, he was still named Jacob. When he was done with the match, he was named Israel. Jacob means heel or grasper. He was born grasping the heel of his brother. But after the wrestling match, he's named Israel, Prince of God. You talk about going from one extreme to the other. There it is. But all those 20 years, all of Jacob's life is leading up to this point. At that point, he became a Prince of God. At that particular point, everything up to them was God's classroom. And at this point, he becomes Prince of God. Now, I have to say something here, interject something. There's still suffering to come in Jacob's life. But you're going to notice all the rest of the suffering in Jacob's life after this is not because of himself. It's because of his children. He's not suffering for himself. He's suffering as a father. All the rest of the suffering comes from his children after this. That's a different kind of suffering. Jacob set up a stone after his dream. He sets up a stone right before his wrestling match when he to separate from Laban. The first stone was a promise to return to Canaan. The other stone was a promise never to return to Laban. Laban kissed Jacob when he first met him. He was ready to kill him when he left. Esau was ready to kill Jacob when he left him. But we're going to see next week in the next chapter, Esau kisses and embraces his brother Jacob. And Hosea 12:3, which we used last week. In the womb, he took his brother by the heel. And in his maturity, he contended with God. I want you to keep something in mind here. A few points. Please remember these. Every wrestling match with God, what is it? What form does it take? And every time I do this teaching, people ask me, well, what is this wrestling match like? What is it? Now, what does it mean we win? Jacob won the match. How do we win the match with God? What is that all about? You ready? Here's the answer. Every wrestling match with God is a struggle to know his name. Every wrestling match with God is a struggle to know his name. Because how did the wet match end? God asked Jacob's name. Jacob tells him. And then he changes it. Then Jacob says, what's your name? He says, well, you need to ask. The wrestling match, you got to know me through the match. Every wrestling match with God is a struggle to know his name. And you know what? I have to confess, God has got a lot to do in my life yet. But I confess, I have no patience for these people who claim to know how God's name is pronounced and then they pronounce it everywhere. I know his name and how it's pronounced. We don't know how it's pronounced. I know how the four-letter name of God is pronounced and then they just blurt it out everywhere. I see no difference between those people and the person who, the plumber, you know, or the guy who works under the hood of your car who curses every other breath. It's the same sin, opposite directions. They're both taking God's name in vain. The one just simply doesn't know the God whose name he's using. The other thinks he knows the name, but he doesn't know the God. He really doesn't know the name either. God's name is not pronounced with your lips, it is pronounced with your lives. When your life has been broken, and when you've defeated God in that match, and you've finally laid hold of his identity, and you realize every dark thing I've had to struggle with in my life was God in disguise. And when the lights came up, it was God all along. It was him all along. When you realize that, you're starting to know God's name. You know, this starts back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. You know where Adam and Eve, they've sinned. Then they hear God coming through the garden and they hide because they're naked. And God says, Echa. That's the same word as the name of the book of Lamentations we read from earlier. Echa, where are you, Adam? Where are you? And we hid because we're naked. Who told you you're naked? The serpent. No? Have you eaten from the fruit of the tree I told you not to eat of? Yes, the woman you gave me, she gave me to eat and I ate. And then he talks to Eve. She said the serpent made me do it. So God curses the serpent. And what does he say? This is amazing stuff. And the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. This whole wrestling match takes place in the dust. And he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, You shall bruise him on the heel. The same verb is used for both. I know our translations want to say, you will bruise his heel and he'll crush your head. Or he'll smash your head and you'll bite his heel. The same Hebrew verb is used in both. What happens to the heel happens to the serpent's head. What happens to the serpent's head happens to the heel. You know what the word is for heel? Ekev. Jacob. In other words, the crushing of the serpent's head and the crushing of the heel take place together. Because they're coming together. And what happens to the one happens to the other. You want Satan destroyed in your life, then it has to be your fleshly appetites. It has to be this rebellion against God is destroyed. When that's destroyed, when your ekev is bruised, his head is bruised. When your ekev is crushed, his head is crushed. They're one and the same thing. They suffer the damage simultaneously. You follow what I'm saying? That's a picture of Yeshua, the woman's seed. When he dies on the cross, you see the power of sin die on the cross. He became sin for us. What you see happening to his body is what happened to our sin. Simultaneously, they happen together. You follow what I'm saying? It is a powerful thing. And it's with this. Whatever you're wrestling with in your life, it's not the government. It's not drugs. It's not Satan. When the lights come on. But until the lights come on, it's the government and it's drugs and it's Satan and fill in the blank. And it's those things because you don't have eyes to see yet. You just haven't seen through the murk to realize I am the Lord, and besides me, there is nothing else. And when finally you are broken, the power of this thing is broken. Because the heel, which is you, the Jacob in you, and you know the Bible says the heart is a Jacob. Who can know it? It's desperately wicked. It's a Jacob. So that's what it says. It calls it the Jacob. When your heart is finally broken, your heart of resistance, your heart of pride, then all the power of Satan, all the power of that thing that you think's been bothering you all along, it's broken too. They're broken at the same time. When Yeshua was killed and executed on that cross, the power of sin was too. Can you get your head around that a little bit? It's a powerful thing. But all of us someday are going to experience a dawn and we're going to realize God was in every one of those struggles. Every single one of them. And then when you come out of it, you realize, I've seen God face to face. My soul is saved. My life is preserved. And you know, Jacob walked with a limp the rest of his life. But boy, he had no fear of his brother Esau after that. When you've wrestled God and won, what's Esau? And when he meets Esau, they embrace. They kiss one another. They weep on one another's necks. There's peace, finally. When you descend into the world, it's for an education. And the way you come out is by being a broken person and realizing God was with you all along. All those bad experiences, all those hateful things you did and said, and all the things you suffered, just like the prodigal son and all that time in there, the pigs in the sty, God was right there with you. And when you come out, you're a better person for it. And you realize there's God with me all along. He had me in the palm of his hand all along. Robin, you're going to say something. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's just the opposite. Yeah. You know, the enemy appears as an angel of light, and his apostles do as well. And you know that the true redeemed life is not a make-believe world. It's absolutely real. It's completely and totally real. And I see people try to live in these kind of airy-fairy kind of, God has blessed me, I'm always happy and healthy, and I'm, and it's like, oh, brother. Well, they'll never truly know God. They'll never truly know His name because they've never gotten in the dirt and had to wrestle with the dark demons of their soul. But when they do, they're going to find God. You know, the Hebrew, I know we've gone over time, but you're all so polite, none of you would dare leave while I'm still talking. So I'm just going to take total advantage of your politeness. I call this a little bit Jacob at Jabbok. I want you to look at how the Hebrew flows here. There's the word Yaakov, Jacob. All right? Yud, ayin, kof, bet. Take the ayin out, and what you have is Jabbok. Now you have to swap the last two letters. We have Jacob, a Jabbok. And you know what Jabbok means? Well, of course you do. It's written right there. He will empty out. He will empty out. Now, what's interesting is the letter ayin is a silent letter. It means I. What could Jacob see in the dark? Zero. He had no, well, he thought it was Esau he's wrestling with. He had no idea. Esau's clear over there. Esau's nowhere in town. Okay? But God emptied him out at Jabbok. But he also added something. If you take the letter Aleph, which is the other silent letter in the alphabet, it's the first letter of the alphabet. Aleph is the Lord and Master of the letters. Numerical value of one. It's the first letter of so many of God's names. And this letter is just a powerful, powerful letter in so many ways. When you add that in, then you have the word Yaavok, he will wrestle. Who is he wrestling with at Jabbok? He was wrestling with the Aleph and Tav. He was wrestling with the Lord and Master. He will wrestle. Yaavok. And just to give you a little hint of how these two letters work, the two silent letters in Hebrew, Ayin and Aleph, there are so many words are spelled identical, except you replace an ayin with an aleph to get a different meaning. For example, the word or, which means skin, is spelled with an ayin, what you can see. When you place that ayin with an aleph, it becomes the word or, light. This is what we see. We see skin. But some days we'll have bodies like Adam and Eve had before they sinned. Bodies are clothed in light. A body like we saw with Yeshua at the Mount of Transfiguration. If you take the word Asher, spelled with an ayin, it means riches, what you can see. But when you spell it with an aleph, when you replace it, the ayin with an aleph, it means Asher, happy. The first word of Psalms, Ashrei ha'ish, happy is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, stands in the way of sinners, or sits in the seat of the scornful. You can take the word roeh, spell it with an ayin, what you can see, it means a shepherd. As a shepherd watches over his flocks. When you remove the ayin, replace it with an aleph, it means roeh, which means a seer, a prophet, one who can see into the invisible realm. And so many of the shepherds, I should say, so many of the seers, start their lives as shepherds. The word kara ends in ayin. Kara means to rip, to rend, to destroy. When you take the ayin out, put the aleph in, it means to read. It means to call out. You know, you want to. Our lives are lives of destruction until we learn to read this and to call out to our God. Well, we could go on and on and on and on, and I usually do. We're going to stop that right there. But can you, are you getting a grip of the wrestling match here? A couple other things, and I promise you I will shut up. When we gain victory in this wrestling match, God is revealed, and we are reborn. We are transformed. And the amazing thing, Jacob left Canaan. One of the reasons was is because Esau was going to kill him the moment Isaac died, right? Isaac's still alive. Jacob never had to leave Canaan. His justification for running away from his brother Esau was completely groundless. And for most people, for all of us, the reasons we run to the world to get away from this, these religious parents, this, oh, they just stifle my creativity, you know, and all that stuff. And we find but that when we come back, we never had to leave. They weren't going to kill us. They were there for our life. You know, they were there for our life and to sustain us all along. And whatever it is that you're running from, when you come back, you realize, I didn't have to run away. There was nothing to be afraid of. Isaac was still alive. Oh, there's so many things we could go into. But our whole goal is to know God's name. To see Him and to know His name are one and the same. To see God and to know His name are the same thing. God's name is who He is. And to know who He is to see Him. And there's a day coming, 1 John 3:2, brothers, it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when He shall appear, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. What an incredible transforming day that will be. All right? I just keep wanting to kind of drive this home. I got to stop, all right? I just got to stop. You're smart enough to get this. Yes, Ken.
We were reading in the ways that we got to see the gates of shame, which red and white, and it was talking about as we're red with blood. When you shame somebody, they turn white, and that's as if you murdered them.
Right? Oh, yeah, when the blood flushes up in their face, you shed blood. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You said red and white. You've said it before, and you don't go on. I didn't know if that was maybe what you were doing.
Yeah, the colors all have mystical significance. It's
never
good. Yeah, I know. Well, one of these days. Just keep coming back. Keep coming back. All right, we have really gone over time. I'm not going to apologize because this is a lesson. It was necessary. I hope you think it was necessary too. Uncle Mike will give you the last word though.
I want to know about in verse 42, 31, where it says, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, will fear of Isaac, and then in similar, he says it again in another verse in this chapter.
Yeah, the fear of Isaac or the dread of Isaac.
Yeah.
I know. The sages refer to that all the time. And is that what your question was, what the dread of Isaac was?
But is that because that he didn't want him to get a wife and from?
No, what does that dread of Isaac mean? I'll be real honest with you, I don't understand it. I've read lots of explanations, I still don't get it. But they say Isaac always represents strict justice. I don't get it, I don't understand it. Everywhere I see Isaac going, I see grace pouring out of him. So I don't know, I really don't understand that phrase. I have no idea. You stumped me.
32:9, he says to God, my father Abraham, then God of my father Isaac.
Yeah.
In other words, it's almost father because of God's my father.
Right. Now, he always refers to Abraham and Isaac, and then future generations refer to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because the covenant was established of those three. And a few weeks ago, we looked at how Abraham and Jacob were opposites in so many ways, and Isaac, laughter, is the one who glues them together and brings them in our pattern. And these three are the pictures of what the covenant looks like and what God wants to do in our lives. You have to take them as a package. So you don't just say the God of Abraham, you say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because the three together help us to know what His name is. Help us to know what His name is. Abraham had a wrestling match with God, but it was all internal. And that's when he's asked to take his son up an offering. That was Abraham's wrestling match with God, and Abraham won that one. Jacob's wrestling match was an external one. It was in the dust. Very physical. And we have to be able to win both of those. Broken in, broken on the outside. And then we can have laughter. We have real laughter. We've got to go. It's going to be an extra bot if we don't leave pretty soon. Father, thank You for this time. And I pray, Lord, You will give us a wisdom that goes far beyond whatever words are spoken. But Lord, as we look into Your Torah, as we ponder these things, I pray that Your Spirit would come alongside to help us to see that You are the Lord. Besides You, there's nothing else. That all the things we struggle with, You're in the midst of them. And so many of the things we struggle with are just in our imagination, just as Esau was in Jacob's. So, Father, I pray we would have the faith that until the sun comes up and we can see things clearly, that we would know in our hearts that it's always You with whom we have to do. That is, in You we live and move and have our being. And you are the one who is intimately involved in our lives all the time, no matter what. And Lord, I pray that you would bless us and you would make us from a heel, from a grasper, into a prince of God, a princess of God, one of your children. So, Father, I pray you do this in our lives, for I know you desire it for us. We ask it in Yeshua's name. Amen.